You remember those of you who came to my lecture just in the previous period will recall I said all the lectures I give are the same lecture. You'll find out now that I wasn't kidding. Okay, now, what I'm going to be talking about today is theory and history, and I'm principally using Mises' book by that name, Theory and History, which came out in 1957. I would say, for those of you who are interested in Mises, which I hope includes at least a good many of the people here, if you find Mises somewhat hard to read, say if you find Human Action or Theory of Money and Credit hard to read, I think you'll find Theory and History much easier. Of Mises' four major theoretical books, Theory of Money and Credit, Socialism, Human Action, and Theory and History, Theory and History is the easiest. It's a very important book. I remember Friedrich Hayek told me how much he admired Theory and History, and he thought very highly of it. I tell you that not only so you'll know that Hayek thought highly of the book, but this gives me a chance to name drop and let you know that I knew Friedrich Hayek, who was one of my teachers. I'm not that good a name dropper, nothing like my teacher, Walter Starkey, was the great master of name dropping, but I tried to learn from him. We're talking about history, especially the philosophy of history, and there are really two meanings of philosophy of history. They correspond to the two meanings of history. Now, when we talk about history, we can refer to particular events that have happened in the past. Say, we're talking about the history of the French Revolution, meaning what took place in the French Revolution or the history of Europe in the years 1789 to 1945. If you took a class in, say, European history, 1789 to 1945, what you would be getting would be an account of the important events during that period, even though that was, of course, a rather uneventful time in European history. That was another joke, incidentally, but nobody laughed. Oh, well, I guess that's what happens near the end of the week. My jokes get worse. All right, so history can refer to particular events or features of events that have happened in the past, but we can also mean by history the discipline that studies those events. So history is a subject you can major in when you're in college. It would be a specific area of inquiry. So philosophy of history has two meanings that correspond to those two meanings of history. Philosophy of history can refer in the first of these to a particular sort of a theory that holds that there's a pattern to historical events as a whole. Instead of saying something like, well, we have the history of Europe or the history of the ancient world, there are various writers, Karl Marx, Oswald Spengler, Arnold Toynbee are among the most famous of these, who've claimed there's some pattern, or Hegel is, of course, another great one who held this, how there's some pattern to history as a whole. That's to say, there was some kind of explanation that governs the way all historical happenings occur. There's some key to history, which is the title of a book by philosopher not in fashion too much now, John McMurray. It's called The Clue to History. The Clue to History. So the idea would be there's some kind of general pattern explaining history. So this would be one meaning of philosophy of history. And I might say a little bit toward the end of the lecture about philosophy of history in that sense, but it's the other sense of philosophy of history that I want to concentrate on here. And that corresponds to the sense of history which we're talking about, history not as events, but as the study of those events. So philosophy of history, in this sense, would be concerned with the activities of the historian. How does the historian explain events? What is the basis for claims that we have historical knowledge? Do we, in fact, have historical knowledge? So it would be questions on epistemology, the theory of knowledge applied as concerns history, would be the topic of philosophy of history in this sense of the term, and that's what I'll principally be concerned with here. Now, here again you'll see some repetition from my last lecture. The historian can use praxeology, what he learns from the science of human action, in order to explain historical events. For example, in his book, America's Great Depression, which came out in 1963, Rothbard uses Austrian business cycle theory to explain the onset of the Great Depression in 1929. You remember in Austrian business cycle theory, and if going by past years, you can be fairly certain there'll be some questions on Austrian business cycle theory in the oral exam. So make sure you, those of you who are taking the exam, be sure you know the basics of Austrian business cycle theory. So in that theory, an expansion of bank credit will drive the money rate of interest below the natural rate of interest, which is determined principally by time preference, and all sorts of bad things happen should that take place. So Rothbard applies this theory when he's trying to account for the onset of the Great Depression in October 1929. So because he's interested in applying that theory, this leads him to stress certain events such as the expansion of the money supply by the Federal Reserve System in the 1920s, in his view, principally under the influence of the governor of the Bank of New York, Benjamin Strong, who was trying to help his friend, the governor of the Bank of England, Montague Norman. So what Rothbard is doing, of course, you couldn't deduce particular details from praxeology like the policy of Benjamin Strong or Montague Norman, but you can apply Austrian business cycle to help you understand the depression. So you pick out particular events and say, why, if you're accounting for the depression, why would you be picking out Federal Reserve policy? Because if you accepted Austrian business cycle theory, this would be, you'd be concerned with expansion of the money supply and of bank credit. Now, another example of applying praxeology is Mises' brief account in Human Action of the Decline of the Roman Empire. So what, there have been various theories on decline of the Roman Empire. I remember one of the most unusual I ever came across was by a man called S. Colum Gilfillan, who had written a book in the 1930s called Sociology of Invention. And he thought that the Roman Empire had declined because of lead poisoning. He thought that there was some evidence based on certain utensils that had found their increased lead content in the later years of the empire. So he had a theory on lead poisoning as a factor in decline of the Roman Empire. But Mises didn't adopt that theory. He said, he emphasized the fall in trade between parts of the empire, so that previously there'd been extensive trade. The Roman Empire covered a great deal of territory, but there'd been a tendency for trade to fall off. And one of the reasons for that was the government followed policies of inflation and price control. So what he's doing there is applying economic theory to history. He knows what are the effects of inflation or price control. And because he has that knowledge, he's able to use it to help explain the fall of the Roman Empire. Here he was, in his account of the fall of the Roman Empire, incidentally, he was relying on one of the great historians of the Roman Empire, Michael Rostovtsev, who's also a great historian of the Byzantine Empire, called Social and Economic History of the Roman Empire. He was a Russian historian who had gone into exile after the Bolshevik Revolution, and Mises used his work extensively. Now, it isn't only Austrian economists or praxeologists who use theories of economics to try to explain history. There are people who hold other views of economics, and unfortunately, there are some of those who don't. There are economists, surprising as it may seem, who don't accept Austrian economics. So when they write about history, they use their own theories rather than the Austrian ones. For example, Milton Friedman doesn't accept the Austrian business cycle theory. And in his account of the Great Depression, which is contained in the book he wrote with Anna Schwartz called Monetary History of the United States, he emphasizes the decline in the money supply in the early stages of the Depression, not the expansion of the money supply in the late 20s that Rothbard stresses, because in Friedman's theory, the decline in quantity of money is crucial in causing the Depression. He's applying a certain version of the quantity theory of money. So if there's a sudden drop in the quantity of money, this is going to have very bad consequences on his theory. So the point here is not to evaluate Austrian versus Friedman's theory of the business cycle. Of course, it's a priori true that the Austrian theory is correct. But rather, I'm just trying to illustrate that the theory that the historian believes in will influence his selection of the data and his presentation of evidence. Now, another case where, just want to give examples where economic theory can influence the interpretation of history, concerns fascism. You remember the fascist movement began in came to power in Italy in 1922 and then spread in various countries in Europe. And there was the related phenomenon of the rise of Hitler, the Nazis, to power in Germany in January 30th, 1933. So the economic theory that the historian holds can have a very strong effect in how they account for fascism. For example, the Marxist view of fascism, fascism is the highest stage of monopoly capitalism. In the Marxist view, that capitalism comes increasingly to be dominated by extremely large businesses. In these businesses, in order to suppress popular revolt against them, will be willing to surrender the political system to groups of armed gangsters or people with who are ruthless people who will agree to suppress dissent and suppress opposition, will keep the workers down and enable these monopolists to continue in power. So in the Marxist interpretation, we find this, for example, in a book by R. Palm Dutt that came out in 1934. Dutt was from India, but he became a leading member of the British Communist Party. He wrote a book called Fascism and Social Revolution, and that was one of the canonical sources of this Marxist interpretation. We also find it in a much more sophisticated way in a book by Franz Neumann, Behemoth, still cited as one of the standard works. So here, fascism is viewed as really a tool of big business. Now, in Mises' interpretation of fascism, was one that rejected this. And in Mises' interpretation, was one influenced by his own economic theories. And remember, one of the things he held was there's no third system intermediate between the free market and socialism. So in his view, the fascist systems were not types of capitalism. They were, in fact, a type of socialism. Now, you might say, well, how can he say that? Because if you look at the fascist systems in Italy and the Nazi system, they didn't have large-scale government ownership of the means of production. So you might say, well, isn't this characteristic of socialism? It's government ownership of the means of production. So how can Mises say that fascism is a form of socialism? So what Mises' answer to this, which you'll find especially in his book Omnipotent Government, which came out in 1944, he says, well, there's another form of socialism besides direct government ownership, where you have government control, where you have the form of private enterprise is preserved, but it's really the government that's dictating to the ostensible owners what they should charge or what wages they should pay or how much of the money you get has to be saved in as the government directs. So the government is really controlling everything, but the forms of private enterprise are preserved. So in Mises' view, fascism then wasn't a form of capitalism. It was a form of socialism. So you see, again, although I find Mises' view extremely plausible, what I'm trying to do here is not argue for that view as against the other view, is rather just to show how the historian's interpretation, the theory he holds, will influence the interpretation of the phenomenon he's concerned with. Now, another important factor that influences the historian besides application of praxeology or economics is that, according to Mises, a historian account can't contradict the results of modern science. Now, remember in my last lecture, those of you who attended that, I must say, in case anyone did, I certainly wouldn't have gone to my lecture, but I guess some of you did. So I said, gave this example of witchcraft that I'm going to repeat, and I said there's a little bit extra that I would add in this lecture. So now we get to find out what the little bit extra is, and you'll see it really wasn't worth mentioning, but I'm mentioning it anyway. So remember, what Mises says is that suppose that there's a contemporary historian was writing about witchcraft. Remember, there were great epidemics of witchcraft persecution in this, say, in the 16th, 17th century Europe. One of the leading French political theorists at the time, in the 16th century, Jean Bodin, I used to know a little bit about him because I wrote a dissertation on him, wrote a book on persecution of witches. He was very ardent advocate of getting rid of witches. So Mises said, well, a historian who's writing today wouldn't say that what was really going on there was that the witches were in communication with Satan. That would be regarded as kind of an outdated myth. But the thing that I just thought is a bit funny, especially if you have an odd sense of humor like me, is that one of the greatest historians of witchcraft in the 20th century was Montague Summers, who was kind of a claimed to be an Anglican priest, but there's some doubt whether he was one. But he actually did take that theory. So I thought it was funny. Mises said, well, a historian of witchcraft, of course, in 20th century wouldn't adopt that theory, but probably the leading historian of witchcraft of his time did favor just that theory. But I don't think this shows, Mises could still say, I think he would be right, that a historian shouldn't adopt results that go against modern science, even if, as it happened, there are some who do. Now, what I've given so far, or besides the parts that I just gave on science, are ways that the historian can use praxeology to help explain history. I gave the example of the Austrian theory of the business cycle and also the Mises' use of economic theory in explaining the fall of the Roman Empire. But there are limits to the use of praxeology. In particular, we can't deduce particular events from the law of praxeology. Because remember, praxeology just gives us a general form any action has. It doesn't say anything about particular actions. It says every action involves the use of means to achieve an end. But it doesn't tell, you can't deduce from that general fact or other theorems of praxeology particular events that happen. We can't deduce from anything in praxeology that Caesar crossed the Rubicon River in 49 BC. That's just something that happened. It doesn't follow from any praxeological laws. And here's another example. As I mentioned, Rothbard uses Austrian business cycle theory to help explain the effects of the expansion of the money supply in the United States in the 1920s, but he couldn't deduce from Austrian business cycle theory that such an expansion would take place. He can say, given Austrian theory, I'm going to look, and the fact that I know there's a depression, I'm going to look to see that whether there was an expansion of the money supply, but he couldn't come up with some argument showing there had to be such an expansion. That wouldn't follow from praxeology because that just consists of general theorems about action. It doesn't tell you anything about particular actions. So here, when Mises stresses this point that praxeology doesn't tell you anything about particular actions, Mises is in part agreeing with the logical positivists who were usually his enemies. The logical positivists said that a priori truths don't tell you anything about contingent events. Now, what is a contingent event? A contingent event or something is contingent, it's something that might or might not occur. Say, if you say, my giving a lecture is contingent. It's something that might not have happened. I might have not been able to give this lecture. I might have said, well, I gave one lecture this morning. I have to have my afternoon nap. I can't do this. I almost did that, but I thought I'd better not. It would get me into too much trouble. So, okay, so we have, according to the positivist, well, a priori truths are ones that are just tautologies or which is a definition or part of a definition, application of a law of logic. So an a priori truth can't tell you anything about a contingent truth. If something is contingent, then you just have to investigate and see if it's true. If you want to find out, am I giving a lecture at such and such a time, you just have to see whether I am. You can't just deduce, you just can't find out by thinking about it whether I am. You have to investigate it. So Mises agrees with this view. He thinks that particular events aren't necessary. They aren't ones that you can just think about and find out whether they're true. Now, somebody could hold, incidentally, that various events are necessary, but we still have to find out whether they're true. But Mises didn't hold that view either. So he just said, Mises said, a priori truths, such as those of praxeology, don't tell you whether particular events took place. But once you know various particular events took place, then you can use praxeology to help you understand them. Now, suppose Mises is right that praxeology doesn't account for the content of human acts. By that, I mean the particular events. Praxeology is just telling you the general form of actions, what the characteristic features actions have in common. So can there be other sorts of law that do tell you about particular human events? These laws wouldn't be a priori. They wouldn't be things we could just know by thinking about them. Could we have inductive generalizations about particular events? Suppose we said something like, under certain conditions, democratic governments will collapse and lead to dictatorships. So could we have a law to the effect of something like, somebody could say, try to establish what these conditions are and then say, well, under, as long as these conditions are realized, then we're going to have a dictatorship. So Mises didn't accept inductive laws of that kind. He said, there are no constants in human action. So there's nothing like, say, historical law of gravitation that would enable you to calculate what people would do. So, say, with the law of gravitation, the gravitational constant isn't something that's just, physicists just deduced that the gravitational constant had to be such and such. They experimented and found out what it was. So, but once they did that, then they can calculate gravitational force between two bodies. So Mises didn't think there was anything like that in history. There are no constants, so we can't come up with laws just by investigating a particular historical events and trying to come up with generalizations that explain them. And in Mises' view, human free choice is what he calls an ultimate given. Now, it's a rather difficult topic, what exactly Mises thought about human choice in relation to determinism. He seems, in some sense, to be a determinist in meaning that all human choices really do have causes that account for them, but he thinks that we don't have any access to these causes. So by ultimate given, he means that we can't go beyond human choice. We have to accept human choices, and we don't have a basis for explaining human choices in terms of something else. Supposing, again, that Mises is right and there are no general laws of history. Now, it doesn't follow from that that the historian can't explain individual events. You might think it does, because one way we try to explain particular events, seems like the usual way we try to explain an event, is to show that it comes under some general law. So if I wanted to explain, say, why would I fall off the platform if I took a wrong step, I could explain that by invoking certain laws of physics that would describe what happened if I were to do that. So what I'd be doing is I'd have the general laws, and then I'd have particular things that had happened, and that would enable me to come up with an explanation, say, of why I fell. I hope I don't, but you never know at my age. People tend to fall all the time. I hope not during this lecture at any. You know, I mean, I do a lot to get a laugh, but falling is asking a little too much. I'm sorry. So how can the historian explain individual events if, as Mises held, there aren't general laws of history? And remember, you can't appeal to praxeology, because praxeology doesn't enable you to deduce particular events. So Mises held the historian can grasp the event in a way that makes no appeal to generalization. So you can get an understanding of an event, historical event, say like the causes of the Civil War, or the French Revolution, or Bolshevik Revolution, without appealing to generalizations. So in other words, what we're doing in historical explanation is we're grasping the individuality of the event, the particular aspects that make that event just that event, rather than what it has in common with other events. In a general law, if we appeal to a general law, we're saying what we're trying to explain has certain characteristics in common with other things. And there's, by thinking about those, looking at those common characteristics, we're able to come up with a general law, so that'll help us explain this particular instance of that law. But in history, we're not doing that. We're just trying to deal with the individual features of the event as they stand, without subsuming them in some larger generalization. So Mises called this grasp of the individual event specific understanding. And he also uses the German word for Stehen, and he sometimes uses the term thymology for this kind of knowledge. It's sort of a grasp of the particular. Thymology would not have to involve a historical event. You could display thymological understanding, say, of particular people you were, say, talking to or involved with now. But the term for Stehen, or specific understanding, is be applied to what happens in the past. So how does this specific understanding work? Well, based on our own knowledge and understanding, we make judgments about the goals and beliefs of particular persons in history. So since I know how I act, I know how I have certain motives, and I have ends, and I know I can, by looking at historical evidence, I can try to piece together how various characters in the past had acted. I can attribute goals and desires to them, and then say, supposing someone had certain goals and desires, and we assume they had certain knowledge, what would they have done? So that's the way you use specific understanding to explain particular events. And what's involved also in specific understanding is very often a historian can see that there are various causes for an event. Say, for example, he's trying to explain the origins of World War II. He can see, point to causes like the rise of aggressive nationalism in Europe, population pressure, interventionist measures in the economy that made leaders of various countries think that they needed to expand into foreign territories to get resources for their people, or say pressure by efforts by settled powers to prevent the rise of powers to challenge them. So he can get all these causal factors, but the historian needs to apply. He can't come up with some kind of general formula to decide which one of these factors was the most important. He has to use judgment in assessing these causal factors, and that in Mises, as Mises present this, is an example. He's using specific understanding to do that. Now, let's take an example of specific understanding. Suppose a historian's trying to understand Abraham Lincoln's policy, 1861. So what he would do is he'll have evidence about Lincoln's ends or goals. For example, Lincoln wanted to resist secession. Lincoln strongly believed in, he was a strong nationalist. He thought that the states didn't have the right to secede. He wanted to preserve America as a rising power. He thought that by allowing secession, that would just cause America to lose power. America would really have been shown to be a failure. So he also, we know, he didn't want slavery to spread. Didn't propose to eradicate slavery where it existed, but he didn't want it to spread. So we know he had these various desires and others based on historical records of what he said. And we also know, we can know various beliefs he had. For example, he thought that he had enough military power to prevent the southern states from successfully seceding over a long period of time. So if we know, or at least we think we know, what Lincoln's goals were and what his beliefs were, then we can explain what he did. But we're not appealing to general laws. We're just appealing to what we think his beliefs and desires were. So what the historian is doing is trying to understand directly the particular actions Lincoln took. So this is an example of specific understanding. Now, one mistake to avoid about specific understanding is specific understanding or Verstehen doesn't imply sympathy or empathy with what you understand. So it's not, and Mises specifically says it, it's not like, say, understanding art, where at least according to some aesthetic theorists, you kind of feel your way into the aesthetic work. You kind of try to grasp what the artist is saying, and you're in sympathy with what the artist has done. You kind of share the values he has. What you're doing in specific understanding is just trying to reconstruct the thought of the historical actor you're dealing with. Now, it's interesting, One of the greatest contemporary philosophers is Saul Kripke. He's written in philosophy of language, but all sorts of other things. He was one of the pioneers in developing modal logic. I think one great story about Kripke, he submitted a very important paper on modal logic to the Theory Journal of Symbolic Logic. And after this paper came out, I think he did some other papers, it attracted a lot of attention. So he got a letter from the Harvard faculty asking, would he be interested in a position on the Harvard faculty? So he wrote back, thanks very much for your offer, but my mother says I should graduate from high school first. So although Kripke isn't one you would associate with philosophy of history, he actually wrote one of his earliest papers was on the dealing with R.G. Collingwood. And in a later paper, he raised an objection to this method of specific understanding, which, as we'll see in a little bit later, Mises was very influenced by this writer, Collingwood, in giving his own account of history. So what Kripke says is, supposing a historian or biographer is writing about Hitler, and he tries to apply this method of Verstehen to Hitler, isn't it going to result in the historian being sympathetic to Hitler because he's trying to reconstruct Hitler's patterns of thought? And so Kripke took this to mean you're really trying to see things from Hitler's point of view, so wouldn't this tend to make you pro-Hitler? And in fact, Kripke mentions there is a very controversial British historian named David Irving who wrote a book called Hitler's War, where he tried to see World War II from Hitler's perspective. And especially in his later work, he seems to become quite pro-Hitler. So Kripke says, look, this method won't work because if you're applying it to bad people, then this will corrupt your own understanding. But this really isn't correct, although one hesitates to differ with Kripke, but when you're studying the value judgments of others, you're not adopting their value judgments. You're just saying that these are the values those people held. So if you were trying to explain, say, why Hitler had done the things he did, you wouldn't be adopting his point of view. It would just be saying, what were the values he held? What were his beliefs? What was the state of his knowledge? And you could use that to try to account for his action. But you wouldn't yourself be sympathizing, at least I hope not, with what he said. Now, another mistake that's very often made about this method of specific understanding is that it doesn't imply taking what the subject says at face value, and it doesn't imply that you don't compare with what the historical subject does with so-called hard facts, like supposing, let's take an example, let's get back to Kripke's case. Supposing Hitler said in his speech to the German Reichstag, the parliament, right after the invasion of Poland in September 1st, 1939, he says as part of his speech, he was responding to the Polish attack on Germany. So the historian can certainly ask, was it true that the Polish army was attacking Germany? Wouldn't have to just say, I'm just interested in explaining what Hitler's idea, so I'm going to take it as given that Hitler was right. This method of specific understanding does not imply that the historian just accepts at face value whatever the historical actor he's studying says. And we can see what I think is a very important article by Mises that I don't think has attracted as much attention as it deserves, called The Treatment of Irrationality in the Social Sciences. And here he criticized one of the greatest German medievalists, Ernst Kantorowicz. Can anybody tell me what are the two most famous books of Ernst Kantorowicz? I thought all hands would go up. Well, one was his biography of Emperor Frederick II, and then the other is a famous book called The King's Two Bodies. Kantorowicz actually was in Germany, went into exile after the rise of Hitler, and he was a teacher at Berkeley for many years. So Mises criticizes the book of Kantorowicz on Frederick II because what he says is Kantorowicz took at face value the symbolism of the Holy Roman Empire, where he didn't sufficiently ask who really held power in the Holy Roman Empire. He just, according to Mises, Kantorowicz was just taking at face value what the people, the officials in official documents of the empire, and taking. Kantorowicz was very, very interested in symbolism, so he was trying to explain these symbols, but he didn't ask for the realities of power. So, see, I mention this just because it shows you might think when a historian is stressing specific understanding, then he's just going to confine himself to the thoughts of the people he's dealing with. But this isn't the way Mises took it. He did think the historian should not just consider the thoughts, just apply specific understanding to people's thoughts, but these need also to be studied in connection with the realities of the situation. I should just mention in passing, it's one of my many digressions, I think when Mises was criticizing Kantorowicz, it had a kind of a political implication. You see, Kantorowicz's biography of Frederick II was taken to be at the time when it came out in Germany, in the Weimar Republic, was kind of taken to justify the example of heroic leadership. So it was taken by many to be kind of anti-democratic, saying we need a great leader, and Kantorowicz was portraying Frederick II as such a leader. And in fact, Hitler liked that book. He was a reader of the book. So I think when Mises is criticizing Kantorowicz, he really had in mind this kind of he was kind of a covert political message critical of fascism. But as I say, that's just a digression. I just mentioned that just to illustrate how specific understanding does not imply that the historian is confined to the thoughts of particular people. Now, I mentioned already when I was discussing Kripke's objection to Verstehen or specific understanding, the historian R.G. Collingwood, Robin George Collingwood, who was one of those who influenced Mises. Collingwood was quite a remarkable person. In addition to being a philosopher, he was himself an archaeologist. He was probably the leading archaeologist of Roman Britain of his time, and he was a philosopher of art, philosopher of history. So there, one story about him is he says in his autobiography, he remembers when he was 8 years old, taking from his father's books, Kant's groundwork or the metaphysics of morals, but he couldn't really understand that much of the book when he was 8 years old, but he thought he really wanted to learn more about it. So what Collingwood said, this is along lines I've already gone into, is that the historian should recollect the thoughts of the people he studied. So what he said, which is a bit so far the same as what Mises said, that the historian is trying to reconstruct the thoughts of the people of the past. But where Collingwood went a bit further than Mises, and this is kind of, at least on the surface, a rather strange view, is that he said the historian and the subject, if historian has done the job of historical reconstruction correctly, he has the identical thought to the subject. So if I've, say, correctly grasped Lincoln's reasons in deciding to oppose Southern secession, I'm now having exactly the same thought as Lincoln, not just a similar thought, but exactly the same thought as Lincoln did. So really, according to Collingwood, the historian is thinking the thoughts of the past actors, and in doing so, his thought has become identical with theirs. Now, there are other writers in this same tradition as Collingwood who've stressed this specific understanding, and they include, I won't go into details of their thought, they include people like Wilhelm Dilthey, Heinrich Rickert, and the Italian Benedetto Croce. So all of the, Croce was one who especially influenced Collingwood, but of these writers, it was, I think, Collingwood was the one that Mises especially liked, because Mises thought that Collingwood had the best understanding of the a priori nature of economics. So he liked Collingwood in this tradition especially. Now, as you might have anticipated, the approach that Mises gives of Verstehen, or specific understanding, hasn't gone unchallenged. In particular, philosophers who are sympathetic to positivism, such as Ernest Nagel, who was a philosopher who taught for many years at Columbia University. Incidentally, Nagel was one of Murray Rothbard's teachers, and Rothbard took a class of Nagel's on philosophy of social sciences. He thought very highly of Nagel. He said Nagel was always one who seemed to, when a student would ask him, talk to him, he would always have the attitude that he had something to learn from the student. And Rothbard was very impressed with this. So what Nagel said about this Verstehen or specific understanding was, it might be a useful way for the historian to generate hypotheses. Say, if you just try to put yourself in Lincoln's situation and say, why did he oppose secession? Maybe this would give you a good way to come up with give you a good hypothesis about why Lincoln acted a certain way. But it didn't give you knowledge. That would just give you sort of a speculation about how Lincoln had acted, or similarly when you apply it to other people. In a sense, Nagel is right. There isn't, in using the method of Verstehen, there isn't some further step you can take in using it by which you can confirm the hypothesis. You can only judge it by how convincing you find it. So to the positivist, this isn't good enough. You can propose it as a hypothesis, but you have to come up with some evidence for it. So the positivist would say this whole method of Verstehen is too subjective. It's just arbitrary. So what the positivist said instead is that the historical explanation takes place through appeal to laws of history. Just like scientific laws, there are also laws of history. The most important defense of that view is by the logical positivist Carl Hempel, who taught for many years at Princeton. He wrote an article called The Function of General Laws in History, which came out in 1942. And following a Canadian philosopher of history named W.H. Drey, who was an opponent of Hempel, this view is usually called the covering law model, because what you're trying to do in this positivist model, which is also incidentally used by Karl Popper, who claims that he was the one who invented it, not Hempel, is you're trying to explain a particular event, so you say it's an instance of some more general law, so it's covered by the general law. Now, big problem with this view where you say, well, you're trying to explain the particular event by saying it's covered under the general law, is that there aren't such general laws available. So this position would lead to skepticism about explanation. For example, suppose you're trying to explain why Caesar crossed the Rubicon 49 BC. There aren't laws that say ambitious generals faced with an order that they take to detract from their honor will, under such and such conditions, disobey the order. We just don't have such general laws. So really, the Hempel's model is somewhat of an empty gesture. It doesn't really account for how historians actually explain events. Now, Mises held, and this is also something I covered a bit in my last lecture, historians use a technique that is like specific understanding of a particular historical actor's thoughts, which is the construction of ideal types. And the most famous proponent of ideal types was Max Weber. Now, here, ideal doesn't mean perfect in the sense of the ideal state, meaning the perfect state. It means not found in the real world. So you construct an ideal type by bringing together certain characteristics, such as personality types. For example, you could have the ideal type of the bourgeois. So you postulate, say, someone who is motivated exclusively by certain goals, not a real world mix of goals. Say in the real world, people would be motivated by, even people who like accumulating money have other things. Say Bill Gates has other goals besides just accumulating as much money as he can. But in an ideal type, you would just take someone to be assigned certain motivations to the person, say, how would someone with those motivations act? And ideal types are assemblies of characteristics, and they don't have strict definitions. They're just, you can give various items that in general characterize an ideal type, but you don't have to fulfill strict criteria to be an example of the ideal type. And one point at which Weber differed from Mises was Weber thought the rational actor was an ideal type. It's only kind of people who use calculations to achieve ends who are examples of rational actor. But Mises disagreed with that. He thought that in his sense, all action was rational. He didn't really mean that much, but he just meant that all action uses means that the actor thinks are suitable to attain his end. And the last thing I'll mention, we're about out of time, is that basic principle of praxeology is that only individuals act. This is one I discussed in other lectures, methodological individualism. And many philosophy of history, remember, in this sense I distinguish, say, their doctrines that say there's a meaning to the whole of history violate this principle because they say there's something other than individuals acting. And Mises gives an example of philosophies of history that violate methodological individualism, and he discusses these in Theory of History. Hegel's notion of Geist or absolute spirit, Marx and the force of production, and Spengler's analysis of cultures, where culture is kind of an independent biological organism that's acting separately. So these all violate methodological individualism, and Mises rejected all of these. I just say, if you read Theory and History, you should pay special attention to Mises' criticism of Marxism, because this is probably one of the best criticisms of the Marxist theory of history. All right, well, I'm out of time now, so thanks very much.